From the home of the Codebreakers and the birthplace of modern computing, this is the Bletchley Park podcast. Welcome to the October episode of the Bletchley Park podcast, the end of the beginning. The Second Battle of El Alamein in North Africa 75 years ago is widely recorded as one of the most decisive battles of World War II. 1942 was a dark year for the Allies. The wolf packs of German U-boats were ruling the waves in the Atlantic, resulting in huge losses of life and essential supplies. Meanwhile, British soldiers were also demoralised in the desert in North Africa. El Alamein, which lies 150 miles west of the Egyptian capital Cairo, was of huge tactical importance for both the Axis and Allied forces. Part of this was about access to oil. Control of the Suez Canal would have given Germany the keys to the Middle East's entire oil supply. The leaders on both sides were notable, if not notorious. Rommel was known as a master tactician, while Montgomery was reputedly prickly and opinionated. So what does all this have to do with Bletchley Park? Well, Rommel's attack plan was confirmed by intercepts, which were deciphered and translated by the boffins of the top-secret government code and cipher school. This gave the Allies an unseen advantage as they went into this crucial battle. Coming up, we'll get a personal perspective on this slice of history with Bletchley Park's good friend, the historian Dan Snow. He'll be looking back on a trip to the battlefield he made with his dad, which you might remember seeing on the telly. But first, let's put some meat on the bones of this story with Bletchley Park's research historian, Dr. David Kenyon.
This is Bletchley Park. It happened here.
It's 1942. Can we just break it down a little bit and look at why both sides were in North Africa?
Well, it's the fault of the Italians, really. Britain, even before World War II, had a major strategic interest in the Mediterranean because of the Suez Canal and the routes to India and to the oil-rich Middle East. So the Royal Navy and the British government are very keen to protect their interests in that area. On the other hand, Mussolini has this ambition of recreating the Roman Empire, essentially, and he wants to expand the Italian colonies around the Mediterranean and make himself sort of the new Caesar. So in June 1940, when it looks like the Battle of France is ending, you know, after the Dunkirk evacuation, it looks like Britain's basically beaten, Mussolini goes, well, this is a great time to join in World War II and, you know, claim some of the credit. So he, in 1940, declares war on Britain and invades Egypt from Libya, which at that time is an Italian colony.
La dichiarazione di guerra è già stata consegnata agli ambasciatori di Gran Bretagna e di Francia.
This doesn't go well for the Italians, and the rest of 1940 and the winter of 1940-41, the Italian army gets massively beaten by the British forces in Egypt. Over 200,000 Italians become prisoners of war. And because Mussolini by this time is Hitler's most significant ally, Hitler can't let him lose. So in February 1941, Hitler sends initially a relatively small force of German troops under the famous Field Marshal Rommel. He wasn't Field Marshal at that point, but he's sent as commander of this quite small force, and he gets involved from February of 1941 in supporting the Italians and fighting against the British. I mean, people remember the war in North Africa for Rommel and the Africa Corps, but actually for a lot of the time during the campaign, German forces are in the minority. There's a lot more Italians than there are Germans. But both countries are involved fighting the British. And during that campaign, advantage swings back and forth between the two sides, and both armies advance and retreat hundreds and hundreds of miles across the desert, as each have their varying successes and failures.
Marschall Rommel überreicht dem Panzergrenadier Günther Halm das Ritterkreuz zum Eisernen Kreuz.
Ich habe die Freude, Ihnen im Namen des Führers die hohe Auszeichnung auszuhändigen.
Günther Halm ist erst 19 Jahre alt. Als Richtschütze einer Pack schoss er unter schwierigsten Bedingungen 7 Britenpanzer ab.
Ich gratuliere Sie zu dieser Auszeichnung und hoffe, dass Sie sie gesund nach Hause bringen. Wer so ein Kerl ist, der wird immer so ein Kerl sein, bei jeder Gelegenheit. Das erwarte ich natürlich von Ihnen.
By the time you get to the summer of 1942, with all this additional German support, the Axis army is doing very, very well. And it's looking pretty grim for the British position in Egypt. The Germans and the Italians have pushed right forward to this otherwise pretty unknown place called El Alamein, which is basically a little railway station on the coastal railway line. But the point about it is, at that point, to the south of it is a huge area of impassable desert called the Katara Depression, which is, as the name implies, it's a big marshy, low-lying area that is impassable to tanks and military forces generally. And the gap between the north end of the Katara Depression and the Mediterranean is only about 60 miles wide. So it's the one sort of choke point in the whole of the coast of North Africa where you can actually defend and you can't be outflanked. So it's the last position that the British can hold with any strength before the Germans reach the Nile, basically. It's only about 60 miles from Alexandria. So they had fortified a very strong position there against the possibility they might be pushed back that far. But by the summer of 1942, they have been.
You say things weren't going well. I mean, that's 1942 all over, isn't it? It was a bad year for the Allies.
Yes, we've talked about this in the podcast before. With the introduction of four-rotor Enigma back in February, the campaign against the U-boats in the Atlantic has been going quite badly. And Singapore falls in the spring of 42, so the British don't have much to celebrate at this point. Things are looking particularly bleak. The tide has turned in the sense that the Americans have got involved in the war, but in the Western theatre against the Germans, there are no American troops involved yet, although Operation Torch, which happens shortly after the Alamein battle, will see the first American boots on the ground in North Africa. But prior to that, Britain's still basically on its own. And against this background, the one place where British troops are actively fighting the Germans, if you like, is in North Africa. So in terms of morale back in the UK, this is the one battlefield that's appearing in the newspapers every day, and the whole national spirit is a barometer to how well the war's going in North Africa. One particularly bad blow is the fall of Tobruk in the summer of 1942. Tobruk had been captured in 1941, and then the Germans had advanced past it, but it had been besieged and held out through part of 1941, and it became iconic as this sort of bastion of defence. And then the British army advanced far enough to relieve it. And then when the Germans advanced again, it once again became besieged, but it became obvious this time that it wasn't going to hold out, and the British were forced to pull out and give it over to the Germans. And it had been such a symbol of resistance up to that point that losing Tobruk had a much bigger impact on the public consciousness than actually strategically it probably deserved. And also Churchill had referred to it in speeches as this sort of, you know, symbol of our resistance. So through the summer of 1942, the campaign is going badly, but also national spirit is so much depending on that campaign to do well.
Front North Africa. Panzer gehen vor. Tostrotz arbeiten sich vor und dringen in kühnem Angriff in die britischen Verteidigungslinien ein. Die harten und erbitterten Kämpfe in Afrika gehen weiter.
So there were two battles of El Alamein. So what happened the first time?
The first one happens in July 1942, and that's the high watermark of the German and Italian advance. After their successes at Gazala earlier in the year, they've pushed right out of Libya into Egypt and are heading towards Alexandria. And they butt up against the Alamein defensive positions that have been built by the British. And that's as far as they get. The German tanks stop at that point. And First Alamein is significant because it introduces a sort of stalemate. It prevents the Germans from winning the campaign outright at that point. But the fact still remains that the Germans are sitting there 60 miles from Alexandria. And the big question is, who's going to attack next? That continues essentially through till the second Battle of El Alamein in October and November. And throughout that summer period, or July to November, both sides are trying to build up their strength, get more tanks, get more equipment, more men. And whoever strikes first, basically, is potentially going to be the overall winner.
It's almost like the trenches in the First World War at this point. You've got each side watching each other like wary cats, but maybe...
It is. The First World War analogy is quite a good one because there are no flanks to outflank each other on. Any attack that's going to happen is going to have to be just a frontal attack on the other person's defensive positions. And Montgomery, who takes over command of the 8th Army during the summer of 42, his plan of attack for what becomes the Second Battle of El Alamein has often been compared to a First World War battle. That's either a good thing or a bad thing, depending whether you're a fan of Montgomery.
Yeah, yeah.
But the same problem exists. Not only do you have the British Army dug in, or the British and Commonwealth Army dug in very securely on the El Alamein position, but because the Germans have been there for some time, they build a very strong defensive position on their side. And in particular, they lay huge minefields. Well, both sides do, actually. The British have laid minefields as well. So you have to imagine two belts of trenches and barbed wire emplacements, very similar to a First World War battlefield, with huge minefields in front of them. And whichever side attacks is going to have to deal with those minefields as well as with conventional forces.
So there's a standoff going on. They're holding the position, the British, and the Germans clearly want to take it over and get through it. How does signals intelligence fit into this story? Basically, what does this have to do with Bletchley Park?
Well, this has to do with Bletchley Park because from almost the moment Rommel arrives in North Africa in February 1941, Bletchley Park are reading some of his messages. Initially, the Luftwaffe create an Enigma key, which is codenamed Light Blue at Bletchley, and that's read more or less from that February point onwards. So through 1941 into 1942, Bletchley are able to break a huge number of the codes being used by the Germans and intercept a huge amount of information. Again, something we've talked about in a previous podcast that doesn't necessarily help. For example, in the campaign when the Germans launched their parachute attack on Crete in May 1941, the British have the complete plan of attack through Ultra, but because the forces on the ground aren't sufficient, the Germans win anyway. So signals intelligence isn't everything. But throughout the rest of 1941 and into 1942, Bletchley's breaking all these different German...
Well, it only
ciphers.
Ever helps, doesn't it? It's never the answer.
Yeah.
It's not a complete answer. It's never the silver bullet.
Well, exactly.
But it can make a huge difference.
In 1942, in particular, they're breaking a number of key German code systems, which the Germans are using to report from North Africa back to Berlin and back to their high commanders. So Bletchley gets a really good insight into what Rommel's planning and what he's thinking about how the battle's going to go. Again, this isn't always an advantage from the general's point of view. The two generals who had commanded in the Middle East before Montgomery got there, Wavell initially and then Auchinleck, who took over from him. Auchinleck's in the situation where he's sitting in Egypt and Churchill is pressuring him very heavily to attack as soon as possible. And a number of different supplies have been sent to the army in North Africa. For example, they get a huge tranche of American-built tanks are sent on one of the Mediterranean convoys, and they make it to Alexandria. The problem with that is a tank built in America for combat in Europe, if you suddenly put it in a desert, it's not going to work very well. The air filters have to be changed. The engine has to be tinkered about with...
To deal with sand.
To deal with sand and the conditions. Also, they're new, so the crews have to be trained how to operate them. There's all sorts of issues. You can't just drive them off the boat and into the battle.
No.
So Auchinleck is sitting there saying, yes, I've got these tanks and stuff, but
I'm not ready.
That's
not the whole story.
That's not the whole story. And also Churchill, rather disingenuously, looks at the number of military personnel there are in Egypt, what's the so-called ration strength, and a huge number of those people are doing vital jobs but they're not on the battlefield. You know, their infantry is only about 10% of the army, you know, another 20% is the artillery. More than 50% are kind of backroom, administrative, logistical people. But Churchill keeps saying, oh, you outnumber Rommel by X to one because you've got this many people in Egypt. Why aren't you fighting a battle? Which is quite typical of Churchill to kind of massage the statistics. The other thing that's going on is Rommel is sitting in North Africa and his supply situation is very bad. The convoys that supply him have to come from, typically from Italy, across the Mediterranean. And because Bletchley Park is reading Italian naval codes at this point, a lot of those convoys are getting sunk by the British. So he's losing potentially 20, 30% of his supplies at any one time. So he's struggling to make ends meet with his forces. What he does, though, is he writes messages back to Berlin where he paints the worst possible picture because he's basically arguing with his own bosses to try and get more supplies. So Churchill's sitting in London getting these intercepts from Bletchley with Rommel going, I've got no petrol, I can't do anything. And he then uses these as ammunition to browbeat Auchinleck in Cairo and say, look, Rommel is clearly ripe for defeat.
It's hard for Auchinleck to then say, Rommel's exaggerating, it's not that bad.
Exactly. This tension exists through the summer. I mean, Churchill actually goes to Egypt at one point to kind of argue the toss in person, which doesn't help. And eventually Auchinleck is fired.
Are you suggesting that Churchill may have been on occasion combative and difficult?
He did fire a lot of generals. Auchinleck gets fired and they're looking for somebody to replace him. And initially they pick a general called Gott, G-O-T-T. But unfortunately he dies in a plane crash. So Montgomery is actually the second choice to command the 8th Army. But Churchill likes him because, you know, if you look at the two of them, they work in very similar ways. But Montgomery is a PR man. He understands, you know, the power of the media. And he makes himself very popular both with the troops on the ground and with the domestic press by sort of getting himself photographed at the right point, making the appropriate sorts of speeches.
Here we will stand and fight. There will be no further withdrawal. I have ordered that all plans and instructions dealing with further withdrawal are to be burnt. And at once, we will stand and fight here. If we can't stay here alive, then let us stay here dead. I want to impress on everyone that the bad times are over. They are finished. Our mandate from the Prime Minister is to destroy the Axis forces in North Africa. I have seen it, written on half a sheet of notepaper. It can be done, and it will be done, beyond any possibility of doubt. What I have done is to get over to you the atmosphere in which we will now work and fight. You must see to it that this new atmosphere permeates right down through the 8th Army, right down to the most junior private soldier. The great point to remember is that we are going to finish with this chap Rommel once and for all. Now, my forecast of this battle is that there will be three definite stages. First, the break-in to the enemy's positions, then the dogfight, and then the breakout. We will do the break-in on the night of the 23rd of October. The dogfight battle will then begin, and it will involve hard and continuous fighting. I believe that the dogfight battle will become a hard-killing match and will last for 10 or 12 days. The enemy will crack. Then will come the breakout. And that will lead to the end of Rommel in Africa. Make no mistake about that.
So you have a situation where Montgomery's taken over. He's taken over Auchinleck's battle plan. He has all these new resources, all these tanks and men and everything else. And the only question is, who's going to be ready first? At this point, Bletchley Park intercepts a particularly crucial message because Rommel, in August, more or less lays out his plan of attack. He draws the same conclusion. He says whichever side attacks first is going to have the advantage. But Rommel predicts that he's not going to be ready until later. He predicts that the British aren't going to be ready before September. And he thinks he can beat them to it and get in an attack at the end of August. He says all this in a message around the 17th of August, and that's intercepted by Bletchley Park and, of course, forwarded to Egypt. So when he does attack in a battle that's called the Battle of Alam Haifa, they know he's coming, basically. And his preemptive thrust is defeated because they know what's going to happen, basically. They have forewarning for the attack.
You could say it's all rather nuanced because it's not as simple as there's something that seems like quite clear and simple that, you know, he's saying on the 17th of August, I can attack by the end of August. But actually, if you already know in the position of the people who are having to decide how to react to this, that he might be trying to under-promise and over-deliver.
Well, exactly. It might be just exactly that.
Yeah, it's really hard to know exactly where that lands. But like you say, we boil it right down. He's coming.
Yeah. And this is the thing with signals intelligence. It never tells you the answer. It gives you lots of hints. And the devil is in the detail. The trick is in interpreting that correctly.
And still predicting the future. Because that's the real trick, isn't it? You've got a lot of information with which to predict the future, but you are still predicting the future.
Absolutely. And, you know, in Orkinek's case, trying to get your boss off your back at the same time because, yeah. You know, it's like being at work and he's reading all your emails before you get them and then telling you what to do. But what it does mean is that throughout that summer, the Allies have a really good window on what the Germans are up to and also their strengths, because one of the keys they break is a network the Germans are using to report daily strengths of personnel and tanks and how much fuel they've got and all these different things. And knowing your enemy's order of battle in that detail, knowing how much kit he's got and roughly where it is absolutely fundamental to fighting a successful battle. And it's that knowledge advantage that Montgomery goes into the second battle of El Alamein having in his pocket.
And so successful it was. What did that then bring about as a result of that?
Well, it might not have felt very successful at the time. The initial encounter, because of the minefields and the nature of the terrain, Montgomery decides that he can't send the tanks in with the first wave. Basically, he has to send infantrymen in to clear passages through the minefields and capture the initial German positions. And then only once the infantry attack has succeeded, sort of grabbing the first part of the German line, he'll then send the tanks through afterwards, and they will then exploit into the rear and achieve the sort of crushing defeat he's looking for. Whether it's deliberate or not, some wag comes up with the code name for the operation, which is Lightfoot, which if you consider the amount of minefields there were in front of these guys, it's a bit of a bad joke. And when the battle starts, infantrymen basically have to get out of trenches in World War I style and set off across an empty desert towards German positions, making their way through minefields and barbed wire. And the support they have, again, in a quite First World War style, is an enormous artillery bombardment. The Germans get shelled to an unprecedented level. One of the things that forces them to do, in some cases, they know they're going to get shelled, so they've actually pulled back to positions in the rear, and the shells fall on empty trenches. But that still has the same effect, because it means the British can capture those positions. The first week or so of the battle is a real grinding attritional slog, but ultimately Montgomery is successful and Rommel admits defeat. And when I say admits defeat, he admits defeat to Hitler. He sends a message, which Bletchley reads, saying, I have to fall back. I can't defend where I am. And Hitler, being Hitler, sends a message back going, you know, no retreat, no surrender, you know, stay where you are.
Carry on.
Yeah. And Rommel tries that for sort of 24, 48 hours, but then realises that after a day or two that it's just slaughter, it's not going to work. And he retreats. Some historians argue that he kind of sacrifices a lot of the Italians because the troops that get pulled out are the Germans and the ones that get left behind are the Italians. But what that does is it signals the final retreat of the Germans and the Axis forces in North Africa, because once they fall back from El Alamein, they carry on falling back. And by the spring of 1943... they've fallen all the way back to Tunisia and ultimately surrender in Tunisia in 1943. Montgomery gets criticised because he doesn't follow up very, very quickly. He's very methodical about his pursuit, if you like. It's hard even to call it a pursuit. It's a sort of follow-up, a cautious follow-up. But part of the reason for that is this battle has seesawed back, you know, 1,000 miles across the desert several times before. And you can understand that he might have been a bit wary about just galloping off into the desert, assuming that everything was rosy. So the follow-up from the battle is quite slow, but we know in hindsight that that was it for the Germans at that point. It was all downhill from there. And it certainly was.
This is not Bertolt, but recording in the desert.
The sound you can hear now is the noise of British tanks moving into battle. It's the night of Sunday, Monday, November 1st, 2nd. And it's the early hours of the morning, and now on this desert, with the sand clouds whirling up behind each vehicle, British tanks in large numbers are moving into battle. Shells by the thousands are being pumped into the enemy. And now here we are at the side of one of these desert tracks, watching the armed might of the Eighth Army go forward to engage the enemy. The moon, just half a moon, is shining down here, the starry night, and overhead there's not only the moon, but the flares which have been dropped, which are shining down on the desert and illuminating this battleground. Tank after tank is going past, just a few yards from the microphone as I speak now. One can't see very clearly. It's rather like being in a fog. It is indeed a fog, but the fog is a fog of sand, because the sand's very soft here, and each tank as it goes past churns up a great cloud.
So that was recognised at the time. It's not just a historical perspective that that was the turning point. That was quite clear.
It was a significant enough moment for people to certainly hope that it was a major turning point. And they'd been starved of any success up to that point. So to win such a crushing victory was hugely important. And Churchill famously orders church bells to be rung in Britain, which is a historical tradition that they would announce major victories by ringing church bells. It happened after Trafalgar, for example. No church bell has rung since 1939, really. Well, I think in some cases they use them for air raids, I'm not sure, or as an invasion warning, but essentially the churches have been silent. And so announcing that that should be done, he was taking a big gamble, because, I mean, if, you know, the Germans had counterattacked a week later and it had all gone pear-shaped, then he would have looked a bit foolish. But, you know, he guessed right. And that's where Churchill comes in with his quite prescient remark that it's not the beginning of the end, but it is the end of the beginning, that it's a turning point.
We have not so far this war taken as many German prisoners as they have taken British. But these German prisoners will no doubt come in droves at the end, just as they did last time. I have never promised anything but blood, tears, toil, and sweat. Now, however, we have a new experience. We have victory. A remarkable and definite victory. A bright gleam has caught the helmets of our soldiers and warmed and cheered all our hearts. The late Monsieur Venizelos observed that in all our wars, England, he ought to have said Britain, of course, England always wins one battle, the last. We seem to have begun rather earlier this time. General Alexander. With his brilliant comrade and lieutenant, General Montgomery, has gained a glorious and decisive victory in what I think should be called the Battle of Egypt. Rommel's army has been defeated. It has been routed. It has been very largely destroyed as a fighting force. Ah, this is not the end. It is not even the beginning of the end, but it is perhaps the end of the beginning. Henceforward, Hitler's Nazis will be equally well armed, and perhaps even better armed troops. Henceforward, they will have to face in many theaters that superiority in the air, which they have so often used without mercy against others, and of which they boasted all around the world they were to be the masters, in which they intended to use as the instrument for convincing all other peoples that all resistance to them was hopeless. When I read, my lords and gentlemen of the coastal road, crammed with the flying German vehicles, under the blasting attacks of the Royal Air Force, I could not but remember those roads of France and Flanders, crowded not with fighting men, but with their helpless refugees, women and children, fleeing with their pitiful barrows and household goods, on whom such merciless cruelty was wreaked. I have, my Lord Mayor, I trust, a humane disposition, but I must say I could not help feeling that what was happening, however grievous, was only justice grimly reclaiming her rights.
It sounds like it was a devastating battle in terms of the losses it brought about. There must have been a lot of people that never went home either to Germany or Italy or Britain from that battle.
Oh yeah, the casualties on both sides are enormous. And from the Allied perspective, it's not just British. There's very large Australian and New Zealand contingents in the battle. And those countries remember it as a moment of significant success, but also a moment of massive loss as well. The cemeteries around El Alamein are very large on both sides.
Any victory in war is tinged with that, isn't it?
Oh, absolutely. And certainly in this context, the nature of the strategic situation, the way the battle had to be fought, this sort of frontal attack, was always going to lead to that. There was no way around it.
When we've likened it to First World War battles, which I gather is quite a common analogy with these battles of El Alamein, because of the sort of on-the-ground nature of it, if you like. But there's this distinct difference in that battles in the desert, because the unique geographical makeup of this location, completely different to land battles in Europe that took place in either war. So we want to get a sense of what it was actually like there. In this instance, we've been lucky. We've got a man on the ground, as it were, someone who's been there and experienced the physicality of the location and its atmosphere, looking back on that battle. Dan Snow, the historian I'm sure everyone's heard of, he made a programme about it with his father some years ago, and you've had a chat with him looking back on that trip.
Yes, and I'm actually no stranger to the desert myself. I was in Libya a few years ago, so Dan and I were able to compare notes. So Dan, you've delved into the El Alamein story a little bit over the years, haven't you?
Well, Dave, I have, because I mean, it's very special to me, the El Alamein story, because I'd just finished university and someone at the BBC said to my dad, what about doing a programme with that son of yours who I've seen rowing in the Oxford Cambridge boat race? And my dad said, no, it's a bloody stupid idea. I'm not a programme son. So I was looking at postgrad options, eventually working towards a DPhil PhD in probably Napoleonic history. And then that person on the BBC approached my dad again and said, it's the 60th anniversary of the Battle of El Alamein this autumn.
You're showing your age now.
I know. I think before saying that, it's so depressing. And they said, what about going out there? You do the story, the top-down story, the strategic, Montgomery and Rommel. Dan is near enough the age of quite a lot of the guys fighting on the front line. He does a sort of tactical story. And Dad thought that was kind of legitimate. And I thought that was really quite exciting. And then went out to the Western Desert. And that was my first ever foray into TV presenting. And of course, it just changed my life because it was the most remarkable place to go. It was an extraordinary story. I was able to meet veterans. I was able to travel out there. And And I thought, this is what I want to do for the rest of my life. This is just this is the most brilliant thing. And when my previous job, my summer job, had been data inputting in a software company. So I thought, this is better than that. And the Western Desert is a remarkable, remarkable place. In many ways, quite unchanged. Certainly, there's been no particular development. I've been on the coastal strip. There's some hotels and things. But the desert itself remains. And huge areas still out of bounds from minefields. We had to go with careful Bedouin guides. He claimed he knew where he was going, but I'm amazed. But
because they laid enormous minefields, didn't
huge
they?
Minefields, yeah, huge minefields, and clearing those mines, as you know, Operation Lightfoot at the beginning of the battle, the infantrymen pushing forward under the big artillery barrage, quite old-fashioned techniques, really. Some sort of what we might say metal detectors, but a lot of using bayonets or equivalent to just tap into the sand, and just clearing those paths for those huge minefields, so that Montgomery could unleash his new Sherman tanks towards the dug-in German armour.
We're talking about, you know, edging forward, clearing mines, but it must have felt incredibly exposed. I mean, I was fortunate enough to go to Libya in a past life as well as an archaeologist. And you get out into the desert and there's just nothing. Miles and miles of rocks. People think it's sand, but it's not. It's rocks. And then just nothing else. It's almost like the surface of the moon in that way.
It is like the surface of the moon. I mean, Dave, you're absolutely right, because we'd gone out, we'd done all the reading, and we'd hung out with the guys at Sandhurst, and they'd given us a really fantastic day-long briefing. And we were talking about a place like Rhizrat Ridge and other features, Kidney Ridge, but also Mitairea Ridge, which in the north was the one that Montgomery was particularly keen to get to. So we were looking forward to seeing some pretty exciting ridges. You know, we thought it was going to be like a sort of windswept, it would be like the canyons of the Colorado. And you get out there and these ridges are 6 foot high, a very gentle slope up and gentle slope down. And if you're fighting a tank battle on a flat desert, those 6 foot high ridges become really important, because you can get hull down behind them and you have a huge advantage, and you can see the enemy approaching. They can't quite see you. But it was pretty disappointing for a television crew, I'll tell you, Dave. But also, we used to drive for miles. I mean, we were trying to be people are rude about the BBC. I mean, we took it very seriously. We tried to get absolutely to the key places, and we'd drive for hours through the desert, this Bedouin guy leaving us. And because it's too hot to work during the day, we'd have to leave the hotel at sort of 3 in the morning. So we're there at 5, 6, 7 a.m., do all the filming, and then back to the hotel by 8 in the morning. So these long drives. And you get there, and we might as well have been filming out the window of our hotel. There was no difference at all. But again, that was a wonderful experience. And it was fun trying to navigate through the desert as well. I mean, navigation, it's been compared, obviously, to maritime navigation. Those are where those young subalterns took their tank columns and took their jeeps and things through the desert. So, and experiencing a bit of that was quite interesting.
You went there when you were quite young, you know, I was a little bit older, and I wouldn't say we're men of the world necessarily, but in the 21st century, we have a much greater understanding of foreign places. For the guys who were fighting there, some of whom, you know, they'd never been abroad before, and then they get put on a boat, sent round South Africa, and they get off the boat and they're sent literally the middle of nowhere. Yeah. And then expected to live and to fight.
Absolutely, I want to live, and as you've pointed out so often in the other work you've done, it's going to these battlefields, and it's even surviving and living there is tricky, let alone the idea of trying to fight in those places. But I mean, we had a car with a bit of shade and some bottled water, but it is exceptionally hot. I mean, it is unimaginably hot. And so you are really struggling to operate during the peak of the day. But of course, they had all the things we don't have to worry about, which is they've got, you know, no cover. They've got issues around sanitation, how you stay healthy, how you stay sane out in that desert. And Germans sitting behind these big minefields and very dug in, but waiting for the inevitable Allied assault. And I mean, I was struck when I was out there, what, in a way, Montgomery, his experience in the First World War were hugely important in shaping him. And in a way, Alamein is a very First World battle, isn't it? And it reminds me of those big open fields of northern France, if you like, those rolling fields. You can see for miles. You can't rely on sort of natural cover. You can't rely on sleight of hand. You've just got to kick the front door in. And you do that with overwhelming preponderance of artillery. You do that with armoured spearheads, which you're prepared for some pretty serious attrition of those tanks and crews. And then it's a bite and hold battle to some extent, isn't it? It's a break-in battle. So it's in the Second World War, I think, particularly in the Soviets and or with the fall of France, you imagine breaking through, fighting battles of encirclement, sowing chaos in rear areas. And Alamein, it's hard to see that you can do that, because there are no sort of weak points and backways and Ardennes equivalents. You've just got to kick the front door in and then wait for German counterattacks and then break them down and then just keep biting and holding, keep pushing the infantry forward, clearing these mines and then making it untenable for the Germans to hold those positions. And so I think it felt like quite a First World War battle. And the build-up of supplies, not only to keep men alive in that, the logistics...
Thing we've been talking about with the intelligence story, that the ability of the Allies to intercept Rommel's convoys, you know, the breaking of C-38. I mean, they're getting Rommel's tank states more or less daily, and they can see the Afrika Korps just running out of everything. And the Germans, you know, they must have been in some senses glad to get it over with, because just every day they were getting shorter and shorter of everything.
Some of the Italian sources talk about extraordinary privation in terms of water and things, and it must have been brutal for those guys.
Did you get the chance to meet anybody, any participants?
So speaking of featureless features, we went to Snipe, which was the famous where the rifles did so well. And I think it was a man called Calliston who won an MC there. And people say, can't understand why it was in a VC. And one of these kind of attacks, they pushed forward, occupied some ground. The Germans were forced to counterattack, and then they used these new 6-pound-ounce tank guns to take quite a brutal toll on the attacking German forces. And I talked to Victor Gregg, who was there, and one or two other guys that were there, and it was pretty remarkable talking to those. So it was, I just was electrified by meeting those veterans at that stage of my career. And so walking the ground and meeting the veterans, and being allowed to, I just come out of doing a history degree at university, being allowed to keep reading history books all day.
I mean, I had a similar experience with a North African veteran who I met in Bristol, who he'd gone out with Royal Gloucestershire Hussars in 1941. And they arrived in Alexandria, they moved out to the desert, they were issued with this brand new Crusader tank, sort of fresh off the production line, spanky, latest technology. And they thought this was going to be their home for the next, you know, however many months. So they went back into Cairo and bought extraordinary stocks of tinned food and chocolate and luxuries and stuff, and they fitted out their tank absolutely, you know, home from home. And of course, day one of battle one, it gets knocked out. They bail out in what they're wearing, and they realise that all of that effort was wasted, because wars don't work like that, you know. And from that point on, he survives on, you know, what's in his pockets, really, because the tanks come and go, you know, and they're certainly not a place to try and set up home.
And then what's interesting, you'll have heard this, where I talked to every infantryman I talked to at Alamein said, I was very glad I wasn't. They keep talking about them brewing up, you know, the Shermans used these aircraft engines that the Americans were producing in big numbers, and they just shut them up right into these Shermans and used petrol as a result. So very flammable. And the Germans would call them Tommy cookers, apparently, and they'd brew up, they'd burn. And every infantryman said, I'm very, very glad I wasn't in the tanks. I'd rather have a little shell scrape in the sand and the rocks. You can just try and get below the surface and get some cover. But every tank guy I talked to, so I'm very glad I wasn't an infantryman, because you felt naked out there, like on a billiard table. And I thought that was fascinating as well.
The grass isn't greener on the other side. Yeah. But a tremendously significant battle. We've talked a bit about Churchill, the great wordsmith, his end of the beginning idea that, you know, this is a turning point. And it does hold true. It was a turning point in Allied efforts. We've covered on this podcast earlier the break back into Shark that happened in late 1942 in terms of the U-boats. And there must have been a sense that finally they were winning, since the previous Christmas when Japan entered the war, having had a very bleak year up to that point.
Yeah, very bleak. I mean, I think Operation Blue, the German offensive in Ukraine and southern Russia, which reached Stalingrad, and by October it had run out of steam, but it wasn't clear it was going about to lead to the catastrophic reversal of the Battle of Stalingrad and the Russian winter counterattacks. But it would have felt pretty grim. The Americans had suffered defeat after defeat. Battle of Midway, of course, had been midsummer, so people paying close attention would have realised that something important happened there. But other than Midway, it's quite hard to see much in the global picture that was positive. And it must have been a huge... Again, we forget what the Suez Canal means, what the Middle East meant to British positions. I mean, historically, when you look at the fight against Napoleon, yes, Britain had a big African empire, but the African empire was, as one famous historian wrote, it was acquired in a fit of absence of mind. You know, the focus was on the Suez Canal and Asia and India, basically, the link, that absolute artery to the Asian empire. And so what the canal meant, what the Middle East meant in British foreign policy for about 200 years can't be overstated. And so that they'd held the Germans back. They defeated the German army in the fields, which must have felt important at the time. I think, again, we forget 1940, probably the most embarrassing and shocking defeat the British army had faced to that point. I'm trying to think, but I mean, I can't think of much worse. Catastrophically defeated by Germans 1940 in record time. humiliation avoided only by the most extraordinary amphibious evacuation at Dunkirk. So I think to defeat a German army in the field, to drive the panzers back, to work out you had kit in your arsenal that could now take on and defeat panzers, 6 pound 8 tank guns that could actually knock holes in them for the first time, I think would have felt really important. And as well as this idea, perhaps as of a you know, charismatic leader, I mean, it's easy to laugh at Montgomery now, but I think that everyone I talked to said that his simple climbing up on the bonnet of the vehicle, telling everyone there was a plan, telling everyone that he knew how he was going to beat the Germans, and then beating the Germans, that I think would have been a huge boost for morale. And it certainly was the end of the beginning. It was the end of a series of desperate retreats. And it was probably the end of feeling inherently outclassed, I think.
Yeah, I mean, you get the sense that with the new equipment that, you know, again, talking to veterans, you get this sense that they had the kit for the job by that point.
Classic British story, isn't it? Is that weird strategic space afforded to us by the Channel, by our naval domination, means that we start these wars. But the Soviets can and the Russians can retreat inland towards Moscow. We can sort of hold for the first 2 or 3 years, repurpose our factories. And of course, the American link is very important with Montgomery, especially his armour. But it feels like British war capacity is up and running. And just as by late 1917, on the Western Front in World War One, you start to think Britain is able to take on and defeat Germany in the field. And it starts to feel like that becomes possible after Alamein as well. And then compounded by terrible German decision-making, you know, pushing vast numbers of troops into Tunisia at the last moment and stuff like that.
You get the classic Hitler moment where Rommel says, I need to retreat, and Hitler says, no, you can't.
Yeah,
and Rommel waits 48 hours and then says, well, no, it's pointless. I've got to retreat anyway.
Well, that's a really important point as well. People say Montgomery, you know, it wasn't a war of it. He didn't destroy the Africa Corps. I'm fascinated by battles of annihilation. It nearly always means that one side has presented themselves for annihilation. So if you look at Trafalgar, if you look at the early stage of Barbarossa, if you look at the Battle of Cannae that everyone goes on about, it's because the one side refused to acknowledge the fact that they were about to lose and stuck to their initial positions or whatever, or the deployment. They end up then facilitating the encirclement and annihilation of themselves. So it's very hard to think of stories where an enemy has run away headlong from a battlefield, but has still been encircled and destroyed. Like, that basically doesn't really happen. And so I think Montgomery, he broke into German positions, he put intolerable pressure on the Germans, he threatened to break out, at which point the Germans disengaged and ran off. You know, whether you look at the Battle of Jutland, if you look at that, when the other side runs away, it's very hard to...
Also, I think you have to remember that the Western Desert Force had been in Benghazi before, twice, and they'd had to pull back again. And the one lesson of recent history in North Africa at that point is advance carefully. You know, make sure you've got your logistic tail, make sure that the ground you take you can hold. Because the old Benghazi handicap, they'd been right into Tripolitania in, when is it, late 40, beginning of 41, again with Crusader and then back again. And so the idea of running headlong after the Germans might have, you know, satisfied the journalists. But the one lesson of the previous 2 years of fighting was you do that at your peril.
And Montgomery was the right man. I mean, he was steady. He knew how to wage massive industrial war. He had the measure of the Germans. He wasn't going to get spooked. And also, of course, he had the logistics.
And in the very 21st century way, he also understood PR.
Yeah.
He ran a political campaign as well. He was in the papers, not only to his own troops, but also for the domestic market, in a way that Auchinleck and Wavell never were. They were old school 19th century generals in that way. And, I mean, we take it for granted now that any senior commander has to be on the 10 o'clock news.
Yeah.
And Montgomery is the first sort of signs of that, I think, as well.
Yeah, and that's important because that's important for British morale, and where morale is connected to industrial output and all that kind of stuff, it matters. But he's got several audiences. But also, he knew that age-old British general thing, which is, we can't lose armies. Britain is a massive naval power. It's one of the world's biggest industrial powers. It can't also have unlimited infantrymen to throw in pointless tasks at the enemy. And he'd learned that in World War I. I mean, his writing about World War I was fascinating. I mean, don't forget, this was a man who, he was injured in World War I very badly. Someone came to give him a hand. That guy was then shot, fell on top of him, and died lying on top of him. And then Montgomery's men came and rescued him that night. I've read Montgomery at the Battle of Lakato, I think he was. He was enraged by foolish orders to advance without proper intelligence into heavy, you know, fixed German positions. So he was a guy who had been for the First World War. He was a student of history. He knew that he only had one army, he wouldn't get another one, and he could not afford to waste them. And so advancing in a orderly fashion along the coast of Africa was the right decision, I think.
Well, thank you very much for dropping by to give us your insights. Well, it's always nice to see you.
No, it's always great to come to Bletchley Park. Thank you.
We will no doubt have occasion to talk again on another of these occasions.
I look forward to it, Dave.
Thanks so much.
Thank you.
Here's some excellent news which has come during the past hour. The Axis forces in the Western Desert are now in full retreat.
Battle Sharm. There's plenty more where that came from.
How significant was this battle and the outcome of it regarded in Bletchley Park's war?
It's an important moment for Bletchley Park as well. 1942, the early part of 1942, is a turning point for Bletchley because after the Actionist Day letter in late 41, beginning of 42, the blocks are starting to open, the codebreakers are moving out of the huts. The whole organisation gears up into its what we refer to as its industrial phase after that point. And El Alamein is the first time that they are able to provide substantial amounts of intelligence to support a successful battle. And they just go on to do more and more of that after that point. And this is noted in the history of Hut 6. All the huts wrote their internal histories in 1945 to sort of knowledge capture what happened during the war. And it states in the history of Hut 6, "It is surely inconceivable that any campaign has ever been conducted before with such advantages as Hut 6 was able to afford our commanders in that period." So the intelligence advantage that Montgomery's been given is unprecedented up to that point, and it's only going to get better after that. From that point on, you look at the battles that happen subsequently in Tunisia, in the invasion of Sicily and then Italy, and ultimately D-Day, this intelligence advantage, this knowledge advantage that the Allied commanders have just builds and builds. You know, for each subsequent battle, our knowledge and understanding of the Germans is better and better, and their understanding of us is worse and worse. So this is a real turning point in that sense. This is the first time that that intelligence advantage can really be brought to bear in a successful battle.
Thanks to the paid and volunteer staff, visitors and veterans who took part in this podcast. To find out more, go to bletchleypark.org.uk. You can follow Bletchley Park on Twitter, Facebook and Instagram. This podcast is produced for the Bletchley Park Trust by MC Fontaine and Catherine White and supported by Audioboom. If you like this podcast, don't be shy. Write us a ripping review on iTunes. Thanks for listening, and we'll have more decrypts from the home of the Codebreakers next month.